we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
My next guest is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker known for Platoon, Wall Street, and JFK, and now for his new documentary, he spent over 20 hours interviewing Vladimir Putin. Please welcome Oliver Stone.
As I said, his courtesy, he never really said anything bad-mouth anybody, and he's been through a lot, and he's been insulted and abused. I didn't sense any kind of a... abused in the press, in the media. I didn't sense any kind of anger about that.
Anything about him negative you found? Anything?
You know,
or does he have your dog in a cage someplace?
If what is wrong with détente with Russia? Why would you be against it? And I don't understand this mentality.
Well, what you've just been listening to there is an excerpt from a recent interview that Oliver Stone gave to the US talk show host Stephen Colbert about his new documentary series on Vladimir Putin, The Putin Interviews, which he filmed between 2015 and 2017, in which he was given unparalleled access to the Russian president, and during which the Russian president gave his world view. He talked about his own background, his family life, his career, how he sees the world, how he sees relations with the United States, throughout which he never once referred to the US as anything other than his partner, his views on NATO, and on all the other issues that concern the world and everyone in the world who's interested in stability and peace going forward. Yet here you have the audience laughing and Stephen Colbert making fun of Oliver Stone. And let's just understand who Oliver Stone is. Oliver Stone is a man who spent his entire life swimming against the tide of injustice, of propaganda, of US exceptionalism. His body of work attests to that. Salvador, Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, JFK, Nixon, Snowden. These are classics that will be analysed and held up in generations to come as works of astounding, not just artistry, but commentary on the state of the world in the time in which they were made. And then you have Stephen Colbert, a man whose body of work consists of the spoof TV series Strangers with Candy, his comedy skits and sketches on The Daily Show and The Late Show. Oliver Stone, who served two tours of duty in that imperialist war in Vietnam, during which he was wounded and during which he was awarded the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart, the highest medal of valor in the United States military. And Stephen Colbert, whose military experience consists of a week one-man shows in Iraq, where he entertained the troops in 2009 with the show titled Operation Iraqi Stephen Colbert Going Commando. And what this interview illustrates is the shallow and ignorant nature of US news information and analysis. They say that you can't blame a mushroom for growing in the dark, and it's people like Stephen Colbert who keep people in the dark, because what he emphasises is that American democracy in 2017 is nothing more than a brand. It's just like Coca-Cola, Pizza Hut or Nike. It's a brand that succeeds to the extent to which people are willing to buy it. And Stephen Colbert is one of its statesmen, one of its most eager salesmen. Why is it that Americans feel that Russia has to be their enemy? Why is it do they feel that they have to dominate the world, that their cultural values are the only cultural values worth listening to or worth having? Why is it do they feel that their cultural values and their political system and how they see the world is the only point of view and the only worldview that counts? This is what's wrong with the world we live in today. Oliver Stone said at the end of the interview, and almost you felt for the man, he says, what is wrong with détente with Russia? What is wrong with détente with Russia? Why Stephen Colbert wants to laugh at that kind of prospect? Why do we have a world in which Russia has to be the enemy? Cartago delenda est, Carthage must be destroyed. Can we not have coexistence? Can we not have a multipolar world? Chris Hedges, the American writer, wrote something very profound, I think, in 2010. He wrote, and I quote, The power structure and its liberal apologists dismiss the rebel as impractical and see the rebel outsider stance as counterproductive. They condemn the rebel for expressing anger at injustice. The rebel is not concerned with self-promotion or public opinion. The rebel knows that, as Augustine wrote, hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and the courage to see that they do not remain the way they are. And when it comes to Oliver Stone, what can we say? This is a man who is to be commended for trying to wake America up to the damage it does and has done around the world over many decades. And those who would attack and laugh at him for doing so, well, they merely confirm the degeneration of a culture built on foundations, not of wisdom, but of crass ignorance. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, one man who certainly cannot be accused of being a liberal is Tim Anderson. He is an academic and writer, and his work on the Syrian conflict in the shape of his book, The Dirty War on Syria, is required reading for anyone who wants to understand the conflict and what's going on. Tim, how are you doing? Welcome back to Hard Facts.
Thank you, John. Nice to be with you again.
Now, what do we make of this shallow American liberalism, this culture in which people would actually laugh at anyone such as Oliver Stone? I think Oliver Stone's a giant. To my mind, his artistic and moral integrity is near unsurpassed. I'd put him up there with Arthur Miller, the great American playwright, and, like Oliver Stone, a dissident. What do you make of America's view of its relations with Russia and the liberal view of Russia as nothing more than a deadly enemy? Where are we with this, Tim?
I agree with you, John, that I did see part of that interview, and I noticed that sort of interaction you were talking about. But, of course, the problem is that this is really the enforced cliches of that culture, that people can't think outside the box. They're not allowed to think outside the box. They're not allowed to examine things independently. A journalist, for example, if Colbert was treating Oliver Stone as a journalist, and I agree he's much more than a journalist, but he was saying, why didn't you just condemn him? That was the official line. Why didn't you repeat the official line? Why did you bother listening to him? I just wonder, the question for me, though, is how much time should we give these people like Colbert? They're out there. We can spend all our time arguing with them. We have to recognize it exists, but how much time do we really want to give to them?
Well, I would agree with you, Tim, but these people do have influence, unfortunately. They do play a part in shaping the mainstream narrative. And unfortunately, despite the efforts of people like yourself, and I like to think myself and others who swim against the tide, and certainly Oliver Stone does that in a very, very dedicated way, you know, we are mere pebbles in a massive ocean of ignorance that is US cultural values, certainly the dominant values. How do we get beyond that? I mean, obviously social media and so on, a lot of people, I mean, I don't think people in America, the regular American man or woman, worker or whatever, really feels that Russia is the enemy, Russia is the problem, Russia is the fount of all evil as it's being depicted, despite the inordinate efforts that have been put to that task, to shaping that narrative. So there is hope in a sense, but these people are unbelievably dangerous in my view, because what they do is they blunt the level of understanding. They blunt any attempt to reach some kind of awareness as to what's going on in the world, because, as you know, America is nothing more than a juggernaut of death and destruction whose history is dripping in the blood of innocent people all over the world, and that legacy continues to this day. So how do we get beyond these people? You say just ignore these people. How do you see us doing so in a way that's effective in terms of reaching people that we need to reach, in terms of providing a different, an alternative analysis as to what's going on in the world and why?
Yeah, no, I don't say we ignore them, but I'm just saying that there has to be some sort of balance there, doesn't it? When I wrote my book on Syria, I said at the beginning, there's an A story and a B story here. The A story is the actual history and the B story are the myths. Now, we can't ignore the myths. We have to deal with them, but we can't deal with them at the expense of talking about the actual events. And if we want to change the way people look at things, we have to present some alternative perspectives, basically. And remember what that, who was that, Marshall McLuhan in the 60s, the media analyst, who said, it's not that the media tells us what to think, they tell us what to think about. So everyone's thinking about Russia somehow manipulating the US election or whatever it is, if they obsess on that, or if they obsess on the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein had. We have to acknowledge that to a certain degree, but can we afford to get stuck in it? We have to create some new narratives out there for people to recognize and identify with. And I think you're right that people are being systematically de-educated, but I think people, ordinary people, if they aren't too blinded by ideology or whatever, they can respond to reason and evidence and, well, just reasonable discussion, I suppose. That's the hope I have there. Maybe people don't form their opinions because of reasonable discussion, but we have to hope that if people do see and recognize a genuine narrative out there, pardon me, they may listen to something different.
Yeah, but while we're on to him, let us take the opportunity to lampoon this liberal American sense of exceptionalism. And I can think of no greater example of the damage it does and the rank hypocrisy than the words of the US Secretary of State and the Clinton administration, Madeleine Albright, in that infamous interview she gave on 60 Minutes with Jeffrey Stahl about the role of the sanctions against Iraq in killing 500,000 Iraqi children. These were figures that were compiled by UNICEF. Jeffrey Stahl asked Madeleine Albright if she thought the price was worth it in terms of that infanticide, because that's what it was. And Madeleine Albright, in words that will follow her all the way to the fires of hell, said, yes, we think the price is worth it. And so when Stephen Colbert trivialises, you know, matters of war and peace when it comes to Russia, because let's be honest, we've come very, very close, I think, to a hot war, direct military confrontation between the US and Russia. And I think it's only because of Russia's restraint, remarkable restraint. And I think these people should be thanking Vladimir Putin, because he, during the course of these interviews, I've watched a few of them, the man comes across as incredibly rational, incredibly wise. He has a real grasp of history, Russian history and world history, and behooves people like Stephen Colbert to try and get beyond the caricatures, to look at what's going on and to question why these things are happening. But given your analysis of the role that a liberal America has played in doing so much damage in the world, and obviously you're closely involved in events in Syria, I mean, give us your analysis, because Obama came to power. He was a poster boy for American liberalism, the first black president. He ticked all the boxes. He came to power. The words hope and change, I think he's bankrupted those words during the course of his two terms in office. Give us your understanding of the lie that is liberal American values, if you will.
Well, I think, you know, to start on the counterpoint here, we're talking on a Russian media outlet which wasn't available 10 years ago, probably.
Yeah.
So the existence of Sputnik and RT and some other, and Telesur in Latin America and so on, and the Press TV, those things allow different perspectives there. But you're right, American liberalism is a curious beast. And I think a lot of people have, in the Western cultures, have problems understanding that there is a liberal imperialism and there is perhaps what you could call a realist imperialism. And they're not absolute boundaries, but there was a transition between the Bush regime in the US and the Obama regime, but there was huge continuity there. The project of knocking over all these dominoes in the Middle East was inherited directly. You notice that Obama actually kept Bush's defense secretary for his first term, at least, or part of his first term.
Robert Gates, yeah, that's correct.
That's right, Robert Gates. But, of course, the approach changed, and the approach was, well, what I call liberal imperialism. It has a long history. It goes back to the 19th century. You might, some of the Americans rooted in John Stuart Mill, the famous English liberal who spoke of liberty, but he was also a very strong supporter of British imperialism. He didn't believe in the rights of colonized people to have their own nation. So the American traditions of exceptionalism combine with that type of liberal imperialism to create the new approach, which was called smart power. You might have heard of that, smart power. There was this woman in the U.S. State Department called Susan Nossel, who wrote an article on that in 2004. And on the one hand, it was reacting to the Bush phenomenon, the invasion of Iraq in particular, which there was a huge reaction to. And she was trying to craft a way where what she called the mainstream of U.S. exceptionalism, U.S. dominant role in the world, could do the same sorts of things with different methods. And so we find when the opportunity came round of 2011, we've got these new types of wars. But they weren't really wars. You know, they were civil wars or humanitarian wars or all of the different pretexts that they've given them. A continuity
Humanitarian intervention and new code words were introduced to basically describe the same old imperialist power structure,
But the war on terror carried on in a way with, you know, the war on ISIS. That's a continuity directly from Bush. But they used these proxies. They used other methods. They used the agencies that Susan Nossel as a person, as an example, represents. Now, she came from Human Rights Watch directly into the U.S. State Department where she worked for Hillary Clinton, and she went on to be the head of Amnesty International in the U.S., and you might remember one of her first acts was at the time of a NATO meeting, I think it was in Canada, to say, NATO, keep the progress going. After 10 years of military occupation of Afghanistan, Amnesty International posted billboards saying, we support the military occupation of Afghanistan by NATO, a group that was set up in Europe, you know, something to do with the Atlantic Ocean. So that smooth continuity, you know, with a change of tactic, I think people need to understand that there has been this enormous continuity in terms of the Middle East. It's been one war, really. It's been one war over 16 years, a tremendous war, a huge war with one domino after another. Of course, a couple of them failed. The attack, Israel's attack on Lebanon failed. Syria has been intractable because the US can't prevail there, but they succeeded in knocking over Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. So this is a single project that's been going on for some time, but there is this new cloak of smart power or liberal imperialism, is what I call it.
Tim, it's very interesting. We're going to stop for a short break. After the break, I'd like to focus in on events in the Middle East. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with academic and writer Tim Anderson. We are discussing the reaction, and it has to be described as a reaction, to Oliver Stone's documentary series on Russian President Vladimir Putin, the Putin interviews, and attendant events emanating from that reaction. Now, Tim, you started to touch upon the US role in the Middle East, and let's look at Russia's role in the Middle East, because you mentioned Afghanistan, you mentioned Iraq. In my view, these were defeats for American imperialism. Afghanistan is still in a mess. I mean, it's a defeat in the sense of what their strategic objectives were. They failed to pacify the country. They failed to turn it into a pliant state. You know, they've been trying to get pipelines through the country, but they can't because it's in such a state of turmoil. The Taliban is resurgent. Daesh has a presence in the country now. Iraq, similarly. All it succeeded in doing was draining the American economy. This has had a knock-on effect at home with attacks on the poor and certainly the people of colour there. It's a very oppressive beast, both at home and abroad, yet it refuses to give up. We know that it has a presence in Syria. It's leading a coalition of different forces, predominantly Kurdish forces, under the rubric of the Syrian Democratic Forces. They're currently involved in an assault on Raqqa. We've been seeing increasing incidents where American forces have been engaging Syrian forces, shooting down a fighter jet recently, killing Syrian soldiers or pro-government forces as they encroach on rebel positions or so-called rebel positions. Because American presence in Syria, Tim, as we know, they're an occupying force. They have no legal basis for being in Syria. How do you see America's presence in the Middle East? Because it's not the dominant power there anymore. I think this Sunni-Shia schism, which we see manifested in the attacks from Saudi Arabia against Qatar as part of a really attack on Iran, I see that all these regional powers, these American allies, are following their own regional agendas because America doesn't have the power it did before the war in Iraq in 2003. Do you see America as a declining empire, Tim, or is that overstating where we are?
Yeah, I think to start at the end there, I think that it's very clear that the US is a declining empire. Economically, it's been in decline for at least 30 years, arguably 50 years, but certainly its trade deficits, its foreign debt has increased enormously. It broke the mold for what neo-Marxists used to call the economic definition of imperialism, which was the export of capital. Really, the US is still the dominant power by a long shot, with 800-something military bases around the world, but the largest importer of capital there's ever been, because, of course, a lot of its debt's due to China these days. So its decline economically is very clear, but militarily, because of the way it's co-opted other states, in particular European states, and here's where the whole NATO-European Union thing is such a sensitive issue in the whole of Europe these days, in continental Europe, not just Britain, that really, as Vladimir Putin said to Oliver Stone, you don't really be a member with the US in NATO. You become a vassal. You know, you follow them. You don't have any options there. Similar with the European Union. The common European Union stance on a number of things is very unpopular in a lot of European states, not just with the people, but with the governments as well. But it's something they have a great difficulty in breaking out of. And from my observations in the European situation, it's very closely linked, the relationship with Russia and the relationship with Syria, basically. And there are attempts to break out of that mold. Italy, for example, apparently, according to my Italian friends, is seeing itself as a type of a bridge with Russia. So it's seeing itself as having some different sort of role there. There are European states that are developing better relationships with Syria now, but a number of them, including Serbia, for example, which is quite close to Syria, has a very bad formal policy on Syria because they want to get into the European Union. So the European Union is creating these odd sort of tensions with the European states over their foreign policy as well as their domestic politics.
The contradictions are really deepening. I mean, Angela Merkel has come out against the latest proposed tranche of US sanctions against Russia because this is having a direct impact on the German economy. German economy has a strong presence in Russia, yeah, and in terms of energy supply.
And Angela Merkel is one of the loyalist of what they call the transatlanticists in Germany, and she's critical of that now too.
Yeah, so we're seeing a blowback on, I think, a number of levels, and I wonder if this kind of the shrill condemnation of Russia and Vladimir Putin, I mean, the way this man's been depicted as an amalgam of every Bond villain that's ever been created, I wonder if that reflects a desperation that's creeping. I mean, Washington is in a state of complete dysfunction. I mean, the Trump administration is dysfunctional. But a lot of that is because the liberal establishment is determined that he will not depart from the accepted policy towards Russia. As we know, during his campaign, he mentioned the possibility of resetting relations with Russia on a more convivial basis, and that we could work as partners with certain issues that imperil both, i.e. international terrorism and trying to re-establish stability in the Middle East. But clearly, for the liberals in the state, that is not on the cards. And that, so they're intent on destroying his presidency. And I think that, I mean, I'm no fan of Donald Trump, but it's that issue, I think, that's driving this unprecedented campaign against the Trump administration. I don't think he's going to survive a term, Tim. How do you see it?
Well, I think you're right that there's a political crisis going on in the US at the moment. And I'm one of the people who has a view this is not entirely a bad thing for the rest of the world, because the less that they have political will, and it's clear that Trump, really, contrary to the hot air, is quite a weak president. He's had to back down on a number of things he said he was going to do, and he hasn't been able to exercise a clear will on many of the important issues, particularly foreign issues. And you're right, at the same time, he's fighting this rearguard action that the liberal establishment and their allies, you know, they seem to be the dominant faction in the US oligarchy these days, are determined to destroy him. He's had to adopt more or less, he's had to fall into line with the continuity of foreign policy in the Middle East, you know, for now, even though I think his first instinct was to get out of a losing war, and that was a good instinct. But even it's clear that he thought deeper than that. He actually was thinking wider than just getting out of a losing war. He was rethinking the whole issue of NATO and so on. But anyway, what he did he's been wreaking havoc himself because of his very obscure politics. He went to the Middle East, created a lot of problems there. Now he claims credit for it, the split between the Gulf states, for example. He went to Europe, created a lot of problems there because what he was saying about NATO was seen as an arrogant intervention and more or less accelerated the pace of the dissatisfaction with the transatlantic partnership there, you know. So
I mean, Tim, he has no politics. That's the problem. He came to the power as a blank slate. The man really has no politics, other than the politics of a billionaire. It's self-interest. And I think he just wants to be loved. It's as basic as that. And you said something I thought was very important, because it seems to me that his policy on Iran is being driven by Israel and Saudi Arabia rather than the interests of the United States. And similarly, we've just seen him try to end or destroy Obama's attempt at rapprochement with Cuba. And that's been driven by these Miami, this clutch of really extreme right-wing reactionary Cuban exiles in Miami. So he's almost as if he's being buffeted around by any base, any country he can, to try and in any way establish some kind of credibility and trying to posit himself as a strong leader. I don't think he's leading right now. I think he's being led.
Yeah, I think he is a weak leader. I think it's clear that he, whatever populist statements he made, as a classical populist in a way, he said things that were quite popular about the establishment and the, what did he call it, draining the swamp and so on. he hasn't been able to act on any of those things, really. It is creating a vacuum, in a sense, where the contradictions are coming to a head. I mean, the events in the Middle East, for example, you know, there were always contradictions with the plan B, if you like, of the US to try and partition Iraq and Syria, for example. To some extent, that's happening in Iraq. But there were those contradictions with Turkey. Now he's got Turkey helping Qatar because the Saudis got very arrogant and thought they could discipline their little cousins down the Gulf. And now he's got this serious conflict going on there, which is dividing the enemies to the what I call the Syrian alliance, you know, Iran, Russia, and Syria, and Hezbollah, for example. So the contradictions of US policy, although, as you said before, they've got bases in North Syria now. They've got a base in, at least one base in South Syria on the border, the al-Tanf border. But their capacity to follow through with that policy in Raqqa or anywhere else is not very clear. The Syrians have outflanked them from the south, basically, because they're heading for Deir ez-Zor, their main aim at the moment. And so they've bypassed that base in al-Tanf where they were going to send in some more of their own forces. The other things aren't really working out the way the US plan wanted, Trump or no Trump, basically. And I think Trump being there and having his own conflicts to deal with, in some respects, I don't know that there was any good way out of it for him. And, you know, the good way out was to withdraw. But since he's forced to stay in there, there's no real person at the wheel there. I mean, I think the defense secretary, Mattis, said the other day, he admitted to a committee in Afghanistan. They've got no policy in Afghanistan either. There is no strategy, Mattis said the other day. A shocking thing after 16 years of military occupation.
They've destroyed that country, haven't they? What do you think their objective is with this Raqqa operation? My view has been that they see this as an alternative capital, if you will, in Syria, where the so-called opposition forces can realign, setting up an alternative pole of authority to the legitimate government in Damascus. But there's obviously going to be very sensitive confrontation with Turkey coming up, because the Kurds clearly believe that Americans are going to support their objective of establishing an autonomous Kurdish state or territory in northern Syria. Do you think they have an endgame with this assault on Raqqa, or do you think that they're just blundering around? Because it seems to me that regime change is still on the table as far as the Assad government is concerned. How is this relationship working out with the Kurds as we go forward, Tim, for the Americans?
Remember, going back to what you said about the failure of policy in Iraq and Afghanistan, the plan B to divide states and weaken them is, in a sense, the objective there is not to have any sort of real order or functioning system. If you can't have a compliant regime, you have a destroyed state and you can do what you like, in a sense. If, for example, Obama said he regretted the destruction of Syria. But in many respects, it's crocodile tears, because Syria, in a sense, worked out quite well for NATO and for the US. I mean, the French have got their access to the oil and so on. There's no functioning government there. There's no real political will at the moment to really resist the agendas there. Similarly with Iraq, you know, they're playing this game with the Barzani Kurds in the north, which has its own deal with Turkey and so on. So in terms of Raqqa, I mean, on the face of it, to simplify it, you could say, here's a plan. ISIS is going down the tube. We'll replace ISIS with a fictionalized Kurdish state with a lot of the force from really Turkish Kurds that have come across the border into Syria, because the Syrian Kurds didn't really have serious problems with the Syrian government. Even to this day, notice, there hasn't been really serious conflict. There's been a couple of small conflicts, but no serious conflict between the Syrian army and any of the Kurdish forces so far. Now, this plane that was shot down recently, it'll be interesting to hear the pilot's story. Apparently, the pilot survived. There was some story that he was bombing the SDF. Apparently, that's not true. But if the plan is to replace ISIS with a Kurdish statelet of some sort, a Rojava or a federal, try and push for a federal section, there's still an awful lot of problems there. You can't partition an existing state unless that state's on its knees. They got federalization of a sort in Iraq because the Iraqi state was destroyed. They haven't destroyed the Syrian state. And if the Syrian constitution means anything, if the government means anything, the Syrian people have to vote on any federalization or partition there. They're not going to support that. The Kurds don't have a presence in Raqqa hardly at all. They've got a bigger presence in Qamishli because there's been ethnic cleansing going on there. There are a section of the Kurdish leadership that are opportunistically wanting to take a slice of Syria. But I'm not convinced it's going to work out that way for them, even if they want it. As you say, Turkey will be against it. Now they're getting aid from the Saudis. What's that going to mean? The Saudis don't support the Kurds in any ideological sort of way. There's going to be limits to that, but perhaps the US has persuaded them to do it. So the contradictions between the US-led groups there are rather intense, you know, and I doubt that they're going to be able to carry through with this plan, even, let's say, if the SDF, which is three-quarters Kurd, manages to kick out ISIS from Raqqa. And remember, the Syrian army is also very close to Raqqa now and very close to Deir ez-Zor. ISIS has already started to flee to Deir ez-Zor, perhaps, and Deir ez-Zor in many respects strategically placed, and with the oil and so on, is probably more important. So that's all still to play out in eastern Syria. And this plan B of the US with the Kurds, I think it has a very uncertain future.
Tim, thank you very much for that succinct analysis of events in Syria. As we do know, nothing like this would be happening. Syria, I think, would be no more if it wasn't for Russia's intervention in the conflict, the request of its ally, the Syrian government, at the end of 2015. This is a work of a big, bad dictator, Vladimir Putin, who saves a secular, multicultural country from being turned into a medieval hellhole run by cutthroats. And when I think of the difference between Oliver Stone and Stephen Colbert, I'm reminded of the words of William Shakespeare: "The coward dies a thousand times before his death. The brave man dies only once." You've been listening to Tim Anderson. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.